Hi, this is Smriti Kirvanandan, your host for Health Forward Podcast. One of the most important things you can do for yourself is to take care of your health. Your road to discovering an all-inclusive, empathetic, and innovative healthcare ecosystem starts right now. Embracing imperfections, but envisioning them as the golden threads that intricately weave the fabric of excellent leadership. In this compelling conversation, I'm with my guest, Sunil Gupta, a visionary in the leadership domain. Where setbacks evolve into catalysts for success and kintsugi transcends being just an ancient art form, it becomes a guiding ethos. In this special episode, we delve into the distinctive insights and transformative experiences of Sunil Gupta, an esteemed expert who skillfully leverages the lessons from failures to foster resilience and propel profound growth. Sunil, welcome to Health Forward. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Smriti, thanks so much for having me. I'm a fan of the show.
Thank you. Sunil, you have a very interesting background. A portfolio for career is what I would call it. You have a background in law. You're an MBA graduate, a healthcare innovator. Would love for you to share with our guests just the journey and what brought you to healthcare.
Yeah, well, I think my parents would consider it to be kind of a pretzel-twisted career. I think they're still trying to make sense of what it is that I do. I think when we look back on our career, I think there are always sort of these little pivot points, these moments that make a difference. And for me, it was wanting to be an entrepreneur, like really like trying to do it and not succeeding. I had started two companies that both did not work. And I had joined another company that you might be familiar with called Groupon early on, and we had a good run. We were at one point in time, Forbes magazine called us the fastest growing company of all time. And I was there from the very beginning all the way through post IPO, but then it all kind of came crashing down. We lost tens of billions of dollars worth of market value that never came back. And so that was kind of my almost third strike in a lot of ways in the startup sphere. But what ended up happening is I got invited to be a speaker for a conference called FailCon, which literally stands for Failure Conference. And I'm up there and I'm talking about these failures, and there's a reporter from the New York Times in the audience. Mm-hmm. Well, fast forward to a full length article on failure with my face as the cover of this article. And this was like 2013. And it was just a moment in time when we were starting to, I think, talk about failure more, especially in the startup culture. Mm-hmm. And so the article goes viral, so much to the point that you could have Googled the word failure. Like, that's it, just that. And my face would have been your top search result. So it's kind of embarrassing, right? I mean, here I am. I'm trying to be perceived as successful. I'm trying to feel like I'm successful, and I don't. I'm literally the poster child for failure for the internet. But someone important to me convinced me to do something with the article. And what I decided to do is I started to email all of these people that I admired, from Oscar-winning filmmakers to celebrity chefs to coaches of professional sports teams to leaders of large iconic companies, people who had no idea who I was, but I would email them a link to this article. Mm-hmm. And I would say, hey, as you can see, I don't know what I'm doing. Would you be willing to give me some advice? Mm-hmm. And the response rate to that email was just extraordinarily high. And all of a sudden, I found myself having conversations with what I think are some of the most extraordinary people on the planet. But the conversations we were having were much more vulnerable than they would have been had they been under the penumbra of success. But because I had reached out as somebody who had failed multiple times, they were very open with me about the mistakes and setbacks of their careers as well. And all of a sudden, I started to realize that I was kind of sitting on this treasure trove of data mm-hmm. that wasn't really out there. And I started to apply that to my next startup, which was a company called Rise. Mm-hmm. We did one-on-one health coaching, and we can talk more about that. But it also set up another track for me, which was studying great leaders, which I have been doing for the past 10 years. I did that through my capacity as a CEO at Rise. I was sort of doing that on the side, but then bringing in the lessons into how do I operate my own startup? And those are the lessons that ultimately led me to success. But then I started to write articles. I started to eventually write books. I started to speak in front of audiences. And ultimately, what I do for a living now is I travel around the world. I meet with people who I think are achieving at the top of their game, and I unpack the habits that are hidden from everyday sight, the things that we don't necessarily know about. What are the practices that they do internally so that they can succeed externally?
Amazing. I mean, I love this. And a couple of things I'll share is the reason I started the podcast is to really handpick people, and it's not a sales platform by any means, right? I have some incredible people, including you, but it's really people who have experienced life's ups and downs, but have really come back with resilience, but have also pivoted their story into really making a change, not just for themselves, but for everyone around them. And I really, really admire this about you because you just wear it on your sleeve. There is no hiding. And you even reached out to people and pivoting and using the article and using that as a sense of empowerment. I just love that. One question I would love to ask from a cultural standpoint, right? Being of Indian descent myself, how is failure viewed and how did you manage that? Because I know a lot of my friends and colleagues, failure is not something we ever talk about. I mean, we are completely in denial. So, love your perspective on how do you even manage that at home?
I mean, not well is the punchline. I mean, I was ashamed, and it took me a long time to get over that. But I think that the thing that really has brought me around in hindsight now is that if I was to look at column A being all the wins and successes in my career, and column B being all the losses. There are things in column A and there are things in column B. And yes, the success has been wonderful. I don't want to discount that in any way. But the learning, there is no doubt that that came from column B. Like Groupon is actually a perfect example of this. We were growing like a rocket ship. I mean, we're on a rocket ship for a long period of time. And then when it all came crashing down, while we were on the rocket ship, I learned how to hang on. I was scaling teams, I was doing things, and certainly I was growing, I was learning. But when it all came crashing down and I had to show up every day and motivate and inspire a team when things around us did not look good, that's when I learned the most about myself. That's when I learned most about how to really build relationships, because it's easy to build relationships when things are easy. It's very difficult to build quality relationships when things are hard. And so if I look at the depth that I was able to receive from the crashes, from the mistakes, from the setbacks, there's no comparison. And by the way, one of the questions that I ask, and now having had a chance to study hundreds of people who I think have elevated themselves to the peak of their fields, I often ask, well, what was the experience that changed your life? Or what was the experience that mattered most in your career? And what I've noticed is that very rarely do they come back with a win or a success. It's not, hey, I was promoted to that role as COO, and that was sort of the breakthrough moment. Most often, they'll come back with, I thought something was going to go one way and it went a different way. And I was disappointed by that. But ultimately, it took me to a place that I never would have imagined, right? And being open to what that is very important. In my latest book, there's a section on the art form of kintsugi. And if you're not familiar with that, it's a Japanese art form, and basically it's the art of golden repair. So if you walk into shops sometimes that have kintsugi art, what you'll find is pottery that has literally been broken, but then it has come together through this golden lacquer. And it all originated from 15th century Japan. There was an emperor who broke his favorite bowl, and he sent it to an artist. And the artist, instead of trying to staple it back together, used this golden lacquer to basically identify and almost highlight the parts of the bowl that were broken. And the emperor loved it so much that it became this new art form, but it also became a philosophy, which is that instead of hiding our brokenness, we can wear it on our sleeves. And it's through that brokenness that we ultimately learn, we ultimately grow. There's a Sufi saying that the world will break your heart, break your heart, break your heart. And if you allow it to, eventually your heart will crack open. And it's from that place of openness that we ultimately find strength. It's where we find love, and we ultimately find the happiness that we're looking for.
I love everything. I feel like I could extend this episode time for the whole day because I love everything Japan related, Sufi music, ghazals, and it's so amazing and so rightly said. And I call it finding beauty in chaos, right? At every down situation, it's an art to find beauty. And I love that you're embodying that and really helping others do the same. But I would love for us to focus this session revolving around resilience, because I feel like that's really the core of your essence. And I really admire that. Given our global challenges, loneliness, mental health crisis, all of this critical issues you're facing, and you've stated that long-term success comes from short-term embarrassment. You can learn something from it, which you've kind of touched on in the last few minutes. But what are some experiences that you can elaborate, and how would you maybe guide someone to really pivot the story and to grow?
Yeah. So much of it has to do with our daily moments, our everyday work. And so oftentimes when we think about resilience, sometimes we think of it as a sort of large arc, a large journey, which it is, but it's also sort of these daily moments, right? Where we feel annoyed, we feel setbacks, we feel little mistakes, little irritations. In Buddhist philosophy, there's the tale of the prickly porcupine, which is all about sort of the Buddha would tell this story to his followers about these porcupines that it would huddle together for warmth. But when they would huddle together for warmth in the middle of a winter, they would needle each other, right? Because their needles would stick to one another, and then it would be irritating. And so eventually the porcupines decided to disband. They went off on their own. They decided that isolation was the better thing. But of course, when they went on their own, though they were no longer irritated by each other, they were now cold. Right? They were cold, they were lonely. And so eventually they learned to come back together and band together and deal with the irritations, because they knew that that was for the greater good of the community, right? And so the reason that that matters is because when we talk about our dreams, we talk about our goals, difficult roads lead to beautiful destinations. And if we try to avoid those difficulties, we ultimately take ourselves, we sideline ourselves from what it is that we want, right? And I think that we have a choice, and the choice is either to play it safe and to escape the irritations, or we find tools that allow us to go right into the annoyances, right into the grievances, but allow us to survive. And really, if my last book, Everyday Dharma, is anything, it's really about talking about what some of those tools are. The one that I talk about the most is a tool that in Sanskrit is called upekkha, upekkha, which is literally the art of finding comfort in the discomfort. And one of the Western scholars who talked about this the most was Viktor Frankl, who wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And what he was a Holocaust survivor, he was a neurologist. But what he talked about was this idea that in between irritation and response is a space. So in between the things that annoy us, aggravate us, and the way we respond to those things, there is a space in between those two moments. And inside that space lies our freedom. So if something aggravates you and you respond immediately, you do not have your freedom.
Right.
Right? But if you are allowed to create a space, right, even if it's just 1 millimeter of space, you start to open up this idea of freedom. And that gives you control of your life. And along with it becomes the platform for so many other things. And the reason that matters is because, like, if you're listening to this right now, chances are you listen to podcasts, you're interested in personal growth. I know you are very much so, right? And so we develop these tools in our life. We develop all these skills and all this knowledge. But if we don't have that space, then we lose the ability to really deploy those at the moments that matter most. If what we're doing is reacting impulsively to the things that don't go our way, then we're not allowing ourselves to really dig deep into what we've learned and also how we grow in that situation. So scholars today will call this the difference between resilience and post-traumatic growth. Right. And resilience, I think you can look at as the ability to sort of just get up over and over again, which is wonderful. Right. But the reason that there's a distinction with post-traumatic growth is because sometimes when we're resilient, we miss the growth element of it, which is actually taking the moments that we need, a little bit of time after something happens that didn't go our way, after a mistake, after a setback. And instead of just trying to get back on our feet right away, taking a moment to reflect on that. Taking a moment to reflect on how we might do it differently, taking a moment also to show ourselves a bit of a love, right? And an appreciation for trying in the first place is very, very important for what happens next. If we get up on our feet too quickly and we ignore the learning, then we're not actually growing along the way.
You've covered so many layers just in one topic, right? I think the first one, what I'm curious is to expand on this. We live in a world where obviously Sunil yoga meditation comes from India. It's come to the Western world now. But I see a lot of people struggling or dancing on the line between having a social life, really what you shared about the porcupine story, versus, you know, running off into the mountains as it did in Ramayana, Bhagavad Gita, but really finding peace in the mountains, right? Doing some weed or whatever that may take. So I think there's a fine dance, right? Between knowing when to really build that resilience in groups and when to find that solitude, that isolation. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think solitude and isolation for me, I think is overrated when it comes in long bursts. And what I mean by that is oftentimes we use vacations as a tool, as an instrument for dealing with burnout. But if you look at the research, you look at the data, it's pretty conclusive that most people return from vacation and they're more stressed out 1 week after they come back than they were 1 week before they actually left for vacation. Right. And so that's not to say vacations, by the way, aren't wonderful. They can be incredibly important for spending time with family, seeing other parts of the world, getting to a level of solitude. Right. But as a tool for burnout, a long-term tool for burnout, they're not as effective as we make them out to be. And so when we look at top performers, they're not waiting for long breaks. They're not waiting for vacations in order to restore and replenish themselves. They're taking what I call rhythmic renewal. Rhythmical, which means that they're taking active, focused periods of rest every single day. So these moments of solitude that we're talking about and these moments of peace and quiet, we don't have to wait for those. We can start to intersperse them throughout our days. In fact, the average high performer takes somewhere around 8 breaks, focused, deliberate breaks every single day, right? So in an average workday, that's about one time per hour, right? Which for most people, that almost seems unimaginable, right? We're so back to back to back, right? And if anything, the pandemic sort of tightened schedules. Like it's like playing a game of Tetris on our calendar, right? Blocking things off. And if you're hybrid or you're working remotely, it's like you're clicking off of one link and clicking onto another. So this idea of taking breaks is kind of become something that like used to be built into our schedule naturally and has kind of evaporated. And it's up to us to sort of bring it back. And one of the simplest ways to do that is through what I call the 55-5 model, 55-5, which is pretty simple. It's for every 55 minutes of work, whenever possible, you're building in 5 minutes of focused, deliberate rest. Five minutes. Right? 55 to 5. And that 5 minutes can be focused on anything you want, so long as it's bringing you joy and you're not multitasking. So you could be sipping on a cup of coffee. You could be meditating if that's your thing. You'd be taking a walk. You could be doing push-ups, planks, whatever it is that restores you, rejuvenates you, and gets you ready for the next period of time. Now, most people who I talk to, I work with leaders and teams all around the world now. And so one of the pushbacks I get for this, by the way, is like, well, I feel like I don't have enough time in my day, right? And that's my biggest problem. And you're telling me to shrink each hour by 5 minutes. Like if I work a 9-hour day, that's shrinking my workday by 45 minutes. How is that supposed to help me? And the answer is because if you look at the science, and I have tested this out now with countless numbers of executives and teams, those 5 minutes make the other 55 minutes far more effective, far more creative, far more collaborative, far more energetic, all of the qualities that we associate with success, right? And so I think we have been conditioned to sort of see rest as a reward, right? You work hard enough and then you get to reward yourself. What if we were to flip that and actually pay attention to the science and flip it and not see that 5 minute period as a reward, but actually a preparation for what we are about to do.
I love that because you're basically creating a sprint model, right? It's like, how do you rest and sprint faster, better? But that's what the 55 5 minute model is. I love that. I mean, I'm a bad vacation taker and I have to be forced to take a vacation, but also I feel like I don't need to take a vacation. I love what I do. And I don't think I take 8 breaks per day, but I get up at 4, I have an hour in the morning. Yeah, I'm a little type A if you're not figured that out, but but I do 2 hours of yoga, which is my time, non-negotiable, right? And then I have calls and at 12 o'clock, I take a small break. Then at 4 o'clock, I take another break, which is kind of like, that's when I kind of repeat the morning set, right? And then I have my work again to like 8 or 9, but I have at least 4 or 5 breaks. I wouldn't say it's 8. I definitely don't do the 55 5 minute, but I divide my days in a week for different, whether it's creativity, logical work, or a different way of just programming it in best ways when I know Mondays are my slow days, Tuesdays are my most active days. So I've kind of designed it in a way that's most suitable to my energy.
Yeah, I love that. And if there was one punchline from the research that I've been doing with high performing teams and leaders, and this has been over a decade of being at this, it's that people who fizzle out, meaning they don't end up reaching the potential that they want to, they kind of flame out in their careers, very rarely do they run out of time. What they almost always run out of is energy.
Exactly.
They simply just don't have enough gas in the tank to keep doing what they're doing. And 40% of C-suite leaders right now are considering leaving their work at this moment because of workplace stress. They just can't deal with the stress anymore. Now, this is prematurely leaving, right? They didn't intend to leave at this phase of their career, but they're considering abandoning it because they can't deal with the stress anymore, right? So they're not out of time, but they're out of energy. And I think so many of us feel that way right now. The vast majority of Americans feel completely exhausted in this moment. And yet we have been really trained to manage our time, right? And you go to Amazon, you look up time management, you're going to be met with over 50,000 book results. But how to manage our energy? We know very little about that. And one of the easiest ways to think about it is really the way you do, which is creating these transitions throughout the day. So we're not accumulating the baggage. And even when Microsoft did a bunch of studies where they had people wear electroencephalography caps, EEG caps, and they basically studied the brain throughout the day. And what they found is that people who had no breaks throughout the day would continue to have a more stressful and stressful state, right? And it happened relatively early. Like after a couple of meetings, you could see the brain starting to decline, right? It wasn't as creative, it wasn't as energetic. But for people who had breaks, they were able to maintain the same state that they had at the beginning of the day all the way to the end of the day, just by taking breaks in between.
Yes, no, I love this conversation. I think anyone listening, I've always complained that, Simi, you have too much energy. How do you do many things? I think this is the secret. It's energy management and not time management, right? And I think when you manage the other one automatically unlocks itself. So I love this conversation. This gets us to our next question. Momentum and Backable are your concepts and books. One focusing on preventing burnout and the other is The Art of Persuasion. I find them very interconnected, reflecting on the ability to delegate and obviously the essence of leadership. What techniques do you think leaders can adapt on both?
Yeah, I mean, Pablo Picasso said that the meaning of life is to find your gift and the purpose of life is to give it away. And for me, these two concepts are how do we find our gift and then how do we share that with the world? Right. And ultimately, I think that's the question that we all have to answer. And I think it begins with what I call inner success and not outer success. So let's define the two. Outer success is wealth, it's status, it's achievement. It's all the things we think about when we climb the ladder at work. But inner success is fulfillment. It's joy. It's a sense of meaning and a sense of purpose. Right. And neither one is bad. Right. Meaning like oftentimes if you go on Instagram or you go on social, you'll see some debates like, hey, you should be paying attention to. You have people who are completely optimized for outer success. And then you have sort of almost shaming ambition posts where they say, like, don't pay attention to any of that stuff. Just pay attention to like joy and meaning. Right. Like, and I don't think you have to choose one or the other. I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to be ambitious in life. But I think what we know for sure is that outer success, while wonderful, will not lead you to inner success,
right?
Meaning all the wealth and status achievement in the world isn't going to fill that hole of joy and meaning and purpose. It doesn't work that way. Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar, who was at Harvard, he's now at Columbia, calls this the arrival fallacy, the arrival fallacy, which is this idea that I think many of us share, which is that we are going to reach a point in time where we have accumulated enough achievement, enough wealth, enough status, where we'll finally be happy. And the challenge is it doesn't really work that way because every time we hit a goal that we think is going to make us happy, the goalpost moves again and again and again. There was a study where they asked people, how much wealth would you need right now in order to be happy? Right? And they asked people across all different income ranges. But the answer that came back was almost entirely the same, which was twice as much as I have right now. Right. So that was true for people who were just barely getting by, and it was true for people who had billions of dollars in the bank. If I had twice as much as I had right now, I would finally be happy. Right. Which means that we chase this goal of outer success, expecting for it to create inner success, and it doesn't. But what we can do is we can reverse the flow, meaning we can start with inner success. We can start with the things that truly fill us up and make us happy, the quality of work that we enjoy doing, not because of the achievements that it will make, but because of the actions that it will take. And when we can do that, all of a sudden we find ourselves in a situation where we have a lot more energy to give. We have a lot more creativity to give. We have a lot more collaboration to give. We have a lot more service to give. These are all the things that we know ultimately spill over into the outside world, and that creates success. So I think that this again is a pattern that I see amongst exceptional leaders, is that at some point in time, that switch flipped. It's flipped from wanting outer success to really focusing on inner success. What is it that really, really fires me up and motivates me? And then letting that spill over into the outside world.
This takes me back to childhood because when I grew up, my dad would always, he's a big giver, he's a very caring person. He would always state, there's so much joy in giving. And he would always remind me that it doesn't matter what you have in your bank account, whether it's $10 or $1 billion, there's only four things we're going to do every day. We're going to talk, we're going to eat, we're going to sleep. And that's really about it, right? And then there's obviously work, but our fundamentals don't change. So I love that you're focusing on what is this life about and why are we all chasing something, and then why are we living this vicious loop of being unsatisfied? It's almost like we create our own sufferings and then we try to fix it. And I don't know if I have the answer. So what's the answer to that? Why do we want to suffer, Sunil? What is your discovery been?
Look, I mean, this is an age old. This is a conversation, right? You and I are having a podcast here. It's 2024, but this conversation that we're having right now was had thousands of years ago in all different parts of the world. The part of the world that I have been most focused on with my newest book, which is called Everyday Dharma, is ancient India, right? So this is over 1,000 years ago, and the concept of Dharma begins to emerge. And the reason that Dharma emerges is because at that time, there really was a rift that was happening in South Asia. You had certain people that were focused entirely on progress. And like there was a lot of progress happening at that time. It was a golden era for India. At that time, the country had a third of the world's GDP. Huts were turning into homes. Tattered sheets were turning into fine stitch clothing. Like people were having new sources of work. But at the same time, there were also new sources of stress, right? People were not as friendly with their neighbors anymore. They were having less time for their families. And there was a rift of like, hey, like there's a lot of progress being made right now, but is it truly progress? Is it actually making us happier? And so at that time, if you sort of walked around, you would find people who were like getting dressed for work, but you would also find people who were meditating on the side of the street, right? It was a very sort of split culture. And what ended up happening was a group kind of emerged where they said, hey, we don't have to choose one or the other. Like, we don't have to choose outer success, or we don't have to choose inner success. We can sort of merge both of those. And that is really where Dharma, the idea of Dharma, came. It was written about and popularized in the Bhagavad Gita. But Dharma is really about sort of your inner fire. It's the thing that lights you up. And how do you then share that with the world? I have come to see Dharma as the alignment of who you are with how you show up in the world, right? And when those two things are in alignment, you are back at your center. You're back at your core, right? And when those two things are out of alignment, you're not. You kind of feel like something's off. So when you're aligned, when who you are and how you show up start to feel more aligned, you feel confident, you feel creative, you feel lit up. Then when you're out of alignment, you feel exhausted. You can feel lost. You can feel frustrated. These are a lot of the same qualities that we hear from most people who in the workforce today, right? So the alignment of who you are and how you show up each day is where we focus our attention when we think about Dharma, right? And when we can start to do that, even aligning a little bit more, like 1% more, we start to feel a whole new level of creativity. We feel a whole new level of openness and happiness with what we do each day.
I love this. Such great reminders on value mapping and really doing what's true to our each own's essence. Backable. Would love to talk about this. The art of persuasion. See, I find leaders, and I work across industries, and I've seen most of the C-suite boardrooms, grew up in those. So leadership is kind of confused by definition, I find, right? Some people think it is a place of power. Some people think it's now they get to make all decisions. But most of them forget that leadership is really this orchestration of talent, but really the art of persuasion to really get things done to a unified goal. So we'd love to hear your learnings and how are you changing lives of leaders?
I tend to focus most of my time now on leaders because I think that it has never been more urgent, I think, to reach people and to create more emotionally intelligent leaders in the workforce today. You have a lot of people who I think are pretty toxic. And some a lot of it is not their fault. They just kind of grew up in toxic cultures and by default became toxic leaders. And I think we need a bit of a detox right now when it comes to leadership inside organizations. And what that means is retraining. For most people, the person who has the biggest influence on their mental and physical health is not their doctor, it's not their therapist, it's their boss. Right? That's for most people in the workforce. And yet, the vast majority of us are in conflict with that person right now. And a lot of that just again has to do with the fact that like leaders for the most part have learned how to really focus on the bottom line. But the truth is that they don't just affect the bottom line, they affect the overall well-being of the people they lead. And yet they haven't learned what that means, right? They didn't learn how to manage at that level in business school or in leadership training. And that is a big deficit, right? And I think we need to fix that. And a lot of my time right now is spent on that. I think that we can bring the wisdom and character of people like Marianne Edelman, Dr. Martin Luther King, of Mahatma Gandhi. I think we can bring that into the workforce today, right? Compassionate, emotionally intelligent leaders who are paying attention to who their people are, what it is they need. And I think that ultimately it is really a focus on three specific things that aren't being touched upon today. And that's purpose, a sense of purpose, a sense of energy, which we have talked about, right? Well-being, making sure your people are energized, and a sense of belonging. Purpose, energy, and belonging. Again, three things that you don't read about in most management textbooks, but are sorely needed today.
You know, Sunil, I've been blessed with incredible leaders the last 10, 15 years. I've also picked them, so it's a privilege. But if I could clone you and deploy you in different areas to make leadership better, I would love to do that. I think it's incredible that you mentioned the word belonging, because when I give talks on diversity, equity, inclusion, at one point I was just like, there's no point talking about DE&I, because if there's no belonging, the rest doesn't matter. So I love that you're really focusing on the authentic requirement of leadership, not just focusing on the revenue generating leaders, which I think is very critical, especially in healthcare. So this brings to my next question is that if you tie all this up back to healthcare, which is resilience, preventing burnout, having great leadership, how do you think all of these can be bundled and be implemented in the healthcare industry?
I think work and well-being have traditionally been separated, right? It's separated in our personal lives, separated at a societal level. It's like you have your world of work and then you have your world of well-being. For us on a day-to-day basis, what that means is we got our work hours and then hopefully we get time to kind of squeeze in a workout or squeeze in a little bit of health journey, yoga, whatever your practice is. But I think that what we have, I think we have missed. I think the healthcare industry has missed, and I think the overall sort of larger, I think society has missed, is that these two things are not separate. They're intimately related, right? And long-term success for not only our careers, but our health means acknowledging the fact that our work directly affects our well-being, and our well-being directly affects our work. And so these two things have to start working together in an ecosystem. And again, I think where the rubber really meets the road is in the workplace, right? Acknowledging how much of an impact your boss and your work has on your health, right? And also at the flip side, knowing that when people are healthy, they feel good, they ultimately deliver at a higher level. When I was running, I started a company called Rise. We did one-on-one health coaching. We helped over 10,000 people through their health journeys. And oftentimes they came to us because they were struggling to lose weight, or they were trying to lower their A1C or their cholesterol. And we paired them with their own personal nutritionist who would help them sort of figure out their diet and figure out their lifestyle and then hold them accountable to these little habits that they could bring into their life. And it was highly successful. We ended up getting acquired by a larger company, and today it's owned by Amazon. But the punchline for me, all of that was that when people were writing in to tell us about their success, about the fact that they had lost weight or had lowered these levels that they were trying to lower, very rarely were they come writing in to say, "Hey, I fit better into my jeans," or "I look better in my dress." Most times, what they were writing in to say is, "I feel like a better parent. I feel like a better teacher." And the biggest one was, "I feel like a better leader. I feel like I can lead better," right? Which again just shows that like our health, our work, and our wellness, those two things are not separated. They're both essential for sustained success.
Now, I love that you're focusing on, food as medicine, which I'm personally professionally a big fan of. I really think food, the way we eat, how we eat it really has an impact on our thoughts, how we view ourselves, and how we treat other people. So I love that you created rice and you sold it to One Medical, and now obviously it's with Amazon. Congratulations on that. Let me ask this question on preventing burnout, because you've focused so much on that in leadership. Right now in healthcare, we are obviously facing a lot of physician burnout. Last year, we lost about 100,000 physicians. So in total, we have about 800,000 physicians for 300 million Americans, which is not an ideal ratio to have, given obviously the aging population and the physician burnout. We are obviously not giving the high quality of care we need to be giving. And if we need to start implementing ResilienceRx as a program into healthcare settings or even into schools, how do we go about doing that? And what do you think needs to really change?
I think we need to start seeing these as daily habits, right? Like daily habits. There's a lot of science and research around little things that we can do that I think can help us be more resilient on a day-to-day basis. I've tried to include the ones that I found most powerful in my book, because I think that most of us don't have the time to go through big trainings. It's hard. It's hard to do. And we're busy enough as it is. But what we can start to do is we can start to pick little habits, little things, and test those out and start to bring them more into our day-to-day lives, right? And I think that these little habits can have outsized results. So for example, we talked about having sort of the space in between impulse and response as a form of resilience, right? And one of the ways to do that, very simply, is by finding what I call a home base. A home base, right? And so what that basically means is, like, in these stressful situations, what people who tend to be very resilient in the moment are able to do is they almost are able to step back and go to a place inside their body, right? And so oftentimes that can be through a gesture, a touch, right? So even just putting your hand on your chest, and it can be discreet, right? Putting your hand on your chest and giving yourself like just a little bit of a chest rub can be a way to find that home base before you respond to something. For other people, it can be a visual image. I met an NBA basketball player whose favorite thing to do is to think about a stream that he used to visit when he was a kid, right? And right when he's at the free throw line and the game's on the line, what he will do in that moment is he will think about that stream, and then he'll come back to the moment that he's in, right? But breaking things up through a home base can be really, really important. The other habit that I'm still trying to learn is getting curious in these situations. Being curious and being furious are two very different things, and they cannot coexist at the same time, right? If you're curious, you can't be furious. Genuinely, genuinely curious, right? Not like a prosecutor inside a law firm, like a law or legal court, but like you're genuinely curious. You can't be furious at the same time. Literally, those states cannot coexist, right? So, and you can almost think of these as a fork in the road, right road versus left road, and which one are you going to choose? So, in these moments where you feel irritated, starting to get curious about the situation and curious about your response to the situation can be the thing, can make the difference between us impulsively reacting in a way that we don't want to react versus actually giving it the time and space that it needs. And again, inside that space lies our freedom. So I think little habits and almost starting to use schools and I think hospitals as testing grounds. I went and spoke in front of 11,000 nurses a couple of months ago. It was in Chicago, and it was like the most fun I've had on stage in a very, very long time. What an amazing group of people that are doing such powerful work, but also like to your point, very exhausted, right? And what when we went through just a list of habits, we went through seven or eight sort of habits, things that they could put into practice immediately. The feedback that I got was like, "Hey, thanks for making it simple." Right? Because oftentimes we're asked to like read these big texts, asked to like comb through all this information and to like kind of pull out like the things that we know we need to do, or we're spoken to at a level where it's not very practical. We don't know how what to do when we're like back to back to back and running 1,000 miles. We need to break these down into little habits, science-based tools that we can build into our daily life.
I love the space, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to be writing in my office, "Be curious, not furious." It's such a great reminder on how to manage our emotions and how to really navigate tough situations. So this brings us to a last question, Sunil. If you had to share three takeaways for our audience, what would that be?
Oh, wow. Three. Okay. Well, let's come back to, I think, the 5-minute breaks, which we talked about earlier, but I think it's very important. And when I first learned about this technique, I dismissed it because I thought it was way too simple to deal with my level of burnout, right? I was too exhausted. And how are these 5-minute breaks going to help? But I really encourage you to try that out. And even if it means that it's not 5 minutes, but it's just 30 seconds, the idea of breaking up your day with these little moments of just focused, deliberate rest really, really matters. And it will keep you sharp. And as it turns out, a great work ethic and a disciplined rest ethic are actually very much two sides of the same coin. A great work ethic actually requires a disciplined rest ethic. So that's number one. Number two is I think find time for play within your day, right? Every day. Having a sense of play in what you do is very, very important. Alex Lowe was this great mountain climber. He was once asked, who are the best climbers in the world? And he said, well, that's simple. It's the people who are having the most fun up there, right? And that's not just true for mountain climbing. I've heard that in all from all different walks of life. The people who are having the most fun with what they're doing are the ones who perform the best. And you can start to bring in little bits of play through what you do. You can start to blur the lines between work and play. Phil Jackson, NBA coach, used to be an NBA player, had a sign taped in the inside of his locker, and it said, "Make work your play and play your work." And so what are the little things that you can do to start to blur those lines? And one of the most simple things that I do, and it's going to sound like overly simple, but it really works, is like before I walk into something, I ask myself, how do I have fun with this? Right? Even before I came here to talk to you, Smriti, I asked myself, like, I'm going to have this great conversation with this amazing person, and there can be almost this notion of me, this part of me that wants to take like get really serious. Right? Like I'm about to go deliver like this serious information. I wrote this book and I'm gonna like deliver all these like data points. And I'm a researcher and I wanna like talk about the research. And I do want to do all those things. But what I can sometimes miss in all that is where's the fun and where's the joy? And so literally sometimes I just ask myself before going into these moments, how do I have fun with this? And as soon as I ask myself that question, the answer appears, right? There's little things that I can do. And so that's the second thing. And the third thing that I would leave you with is that like oftentimes in life, we see our career journeys or our life journeys as a map, meaning that we have it all planned out. We want to get to this point and then to that point and to that point, and eventually we're going to reach this red X at the end, and that red X is happiness, right? And instead, I would encourage you to think about it not as a map, but as a compass, which is like, where am I right now? And what is the right next step for me? What am I feeling in this moment? Because what a compass is able to do is it's able to really tune into where you are at this moment, right? And it's not reliant on the instructions you laid out for yourself in the past. And that's important because we change, right? The circumstances change, we change, what we want change, the people around us can change. Everything is changing. And so instead of relying on this map and seeing your sometimes inability to follow it to a T as a failure, trade that in for a compass and start asking yourself moment to moment, coming back to center and checking in with yourself and saying, all right, where do I want to go next? And where do I want to go next after that? And it may not be that your path as a result of that is perfectly linear. And that's okay. Because at the end of the day, it really wasn't about the amount of time it took for us to get from point A to point B. It was all the things we saw along the way.
Sunil, thank you so much, one, for bringing so much joy and light into my stressful day as is, but really one talking about nonlinear leadership, really proving that leaders are not born, they're made, and so is resilience. Resilience is built. But thank you so much for your time, and I would love to share my favorite term, which I always remember, which is from Japan, which is Ichigo Ichi, which is for this time only and once in a lifetime. I know that perhaps you'll meet many more times, but I know that this particular experience, this time and space, will not be repeated ever again. But so grateful for you, for the work you do, and for your time to being on Health Forward. Thank you again.
I love that. Thank you, Smriti.
Thank you for listening. This is Health Forward Podcast, and I'm your host, Smriti Kirbanandi.